It's time for the Kick Around, the Ticket's weekly show all about soccer. 2 hours of HSOs on the clubs, leagues, and tournaments of the world's game. It doesn't matter if you're new to the sport, don't worry. This is the Ticket. We're just kicking it around. Now, here's our two soccer nerds, Andy Swift and Peter Welton.
Here come Everton with Damari Gray.
Happy ones and welcome to the Kick Around. Normally Saturdays, screw it, whenever we can get on the air. Here on Sport Radio 96.7 and 1310, the Ticket, where you, the good P1, sits around, talks some soccer and all that implies. You can also find us over on our nifty new website, thekickaround.com. Hi, for those new here or unfamiliar, especially because of the hour we're broadcasting, my name is Peter. How are you? Nice to talk to you. And with me is my soccer-talking BFF and super kick-ass guy, Andy Swift.
Howdy Saturday to you, Peter.
Howdy it's early
been a
Saturday.
While since we've seen each other.
Well, first off, I think we're both surprised we're even here because Well, because at the end of November when we last did a live broadcast, we were convinced that due to ticket programming obligations, we were essentially, and the fact that Christmas and New Year's both fall on Saturdays, we were done for 2021, and we wouldn't be back on live until next year. And then, and that's what we told everybody and promoted and said, hey, we'll just do podcasts instead, which was what we were doing.
You're so hip that way.
And then out of the blue, we got an email from Killer saying, hey, the Saroys are on vacation. Do you want to fill their slot? And in fact, you can do 3 hours because we got an NFL game.
Yeah.
Well, so then we promoted, hey, yeah, we're on from noon to three on Saturday. And then the NFL game got canceled. And so now we're only doing 2 hours.
You know, you just roll with the punches,
people. Yeah, we're flexible. Just, hey, man, we don't bitch. Yeah. We just show up here and talk soccer and all that implies.
Right. And like, there's so much EPL to talk about.
No.
No, because something else happened.
So then the other complication is that essentially all but a few of the games have been canceled due to COVID over in England.
So cooking show today. Awesome.
And
finally,
the one game that is live today is actually on right now as we speak. Leeds hosting Arsenal, which means...
So 5 segments on Leeds Arsenal.
Nobody's listening to us that likes soccer anyway.
So then, cooking show.
Good radio programming all the way around. Yes.
It's okay, though, because we have correspondents all over the soccer world, right?
We do, and I think people love us just because we're entertaining to listen to, whether we're talking about soccer or not, really. I mean, I feel pretty confident about that, Andy. We've been doing this for a long time.
Except you don't like to talk about cooking.
I do like to talk about cooking. I just don't like to talk about cooking as much or in the same way that you do.
Okay. Go on.
Sam, I do want to point out that I appreciate the goal call that you pulled today because I really, really like the reaction. I can't remember this. Is that John Champion? Do you know who that is that does that goal call?
I know it's not John Champion because he works for ESPN. That was an NBC call. So I don't know who it is, but I'll see if I can find it.
Do you have it isolated when Damari Gray scores the goal and he doesn't actually say anything? He just makes a bunch of guttural sounds.
I can get it. Give me 1 second.
Yeah. So this is the goal that Everton scored late against who?
Chelsea.
Was it Chelsea? No, Was it the Chelsea?
Arsenal.
Arsenal. It was the Arsenal game. Damari Gray scores really, really late. And this part of the goal call is really funny because typically, English broadcasters are really good at coming across with a really smart, snappy...
And stoic.
And well-spoken reaction in these situations. It's not the Bob Sturm kind of ecstasy groan that is now so famous.
Yeah, let's review that right quick.
So Damari Gray scores this late goal, and this is the best the guy can come up with. So, was that just because it was so unexpected he had nothing to go to, or the dramatics were so high That was the most natural reaction. One more time, please, Sam.
Is that kind of how you reacted when, was it Zlatan scored his first MLS goal?
Yes.
Yes.
We were sitting here when Zlatan was playing his first game for the Galaxy in Major League Soccer, and he scored that insane goal from 45 yards out, side volley, and I lost my friggin' mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought my goal call in that was pretty outstanding. You probably can't find that. It's in the system somewhere. But so anyway, that was good. So Sam, kudos to you for using that in the goal call today.
It's also the best call we've had in like 3 weeks, just with all the complications.
Mr. Trent scored a nice one for Liverpool. Trent. Alex.
Who's
Arnold,
that?
Arnold Alexander.
Who's he play for?
He plays for the good team from Liverpool.
There's not a good team in Liverpool.
He plays for the good team
There's
from
just
Liverpool.
Two bad teams in Liverpool.
Okay, whatever.
There's one bad team and one worse team.
You two Liverpudlians just knock it off, okay?
I support the worst one.
You do. You absolutely do. All right, so the big news, and Andy, I'm hoping with all of your understanding of soccer business and rules and operations and processes, you can explain to me why or what is going on at the Premier League level when it comes to their decision-making of postponing and canceling games due to the COVID.
So the rules are that teams have to submit for postponement and show why, because of COVID and COVID outbreaks within the team, their game should be postponed. The teams have collectively, though, over the last week, the Premier League clubs have gone to the league and asked just for a permanent postponement of the league, permanent suspension, through the FA Cup weekend, which is in mid-January. Right, like, so I think they're asking for a return on the 17th or 18th to skip this whole time because they said the outbreak's too bad within the teams now. They can't plan. Sometimes they don't know till the day of if they're going to play the games or not. And for the teams as well, their fans are on the hook for tickets, transportation, getting to the games, and sometimes these games have to be canceled. So they're asking for the league to just cancel the games, postpone the games through the 18th. The league has said no. That this is a rapid and quick outburst, that they're going to get through it, that they're not going to postpone any, that they're not going to permanently postpone the league, that they're just going to go on a case-by-case basis. So teams are now submitting their cases for the games to be postponed. What happens, though, is if a team has an outbreak or a team has issues, like, for example, today Leeds plays Arsenal.
Well, let's use the Aston Villa Burnley one better, because that game was scheduled to be played this morning, and then they canceled it 2 hours out from the game.
Yeah.
So people are traveling, trying to get there.
Those are because a positive test that morning that came back positive.
Okay.
So they had to wait and see how the test came out, and the test came out, if there were a few positive tests, it put them over that edge. But I bet, who was the home team? Because a lot has to do, like, the visiting team is a lot more
Is it Villa Park?
Inclined to ask for the postponement, because they're not having to, well, they're inconveniencing their supporters as well, because the supporters are traveling. Everybody's getting inconvenienced. So the bottom line is the Premier League does not want to permanently suspend the league, because the fixture, it's a very congested part of the year, right? It's already like a normal year. This time of the year in England is very congested because of the holiday schedule. It's kind of a tradition in the Premier League. But especially more so now with everything being especially congested because of the world having to adapt to the new World Cup calendar, right?
Right. The World Cup is happening in December of next year.
Yeah,
so everything's kind of front-loaded.
Right.
Yeah, so what's interesting is that the Premier League the last few seasons has tried to build in this fake winter break in January. I think, isn't it January?
Well,
or is it February?
I thought it was later than January.
Okay, maybe it's, well, so they may end up having to use that.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know, Tottenham's a great example. So Tottenham plays Liverpool tomorrow. Tottenham feels like they haven't played in a month, it feels like.
Yeah.
They're already behind four games that have been suspended, and they still have a weird COVID situation going on, but they are still scheduled to play tomorrow. There are three games tomorrow, which ironically, are made up of the three league leaders. Chelsea plays, City plays, mm-hmm. and Liverpool plays, all, you know, I think in a sequence of three games tomorrow.
Yeah. But it's for that reason that the league right now, if they suspend all these games and then they have to make up all these other games that have already been suspended, what a nightmare scenario.
Don't really have a lot of space to put them in because they're already at the compacted, squashed part of their schedule, which is the Christmas, New Year's period.
And as they look ahead, they can't, the season can't be extended because they're having to start earlier because of the World Cup being played at a weird time.
So Tottenham also has the additional issue that they've got the that conference, that European Conference League game against Rennes that is, I guess the word is, it's supposed to, by rules, be completed by the end of the year, but nobody knows where Tottenham's going to fit that in.
Yep.
So all this stuff is going on. It's kind of a mess, and it makes for difficulty in doing a soccer show when all the games get canceled. But the good news is, Andy, you and I can make up for that because we have Daniel Robertson is going to call us here in a little bit to talk about Serie A. He's got some stuff to talk about what's going over in Italy. Weston McKennie is back from injury and started for Juventus today.
And did you follow the Champions League draw and that fiasco?
Oh, yeah.
So Liverpool went from an easy game, I forget who, I think Salzburg,
here we go.
To Inter. No, it's fine, whatever. But I want to ask him about Inter.
All right. We can do that. Sounds like you're upset about, you know.
No, it's just
the
result. They got a tough draw.
He's already sandbagging.
I forget when Everton's playing in the Champions League. Who did they draw?
In like five years, probably. Hopefully.
Burn.
Okay.
Burn.
Can't lose in the Champions League if you don't play in the Champions League.
And then Tyler Kern's going to check in later next hour about the Bundesliga.
And we have to call him out on something, Peter.
Yeah, he promised us that Jesse Marsh was safe. And that turned out not to be true. And then the other highlight on the show today is, if you're familiar with a book that Andy, at least I've talked about it a lot. Andy, have you actually ever read Inverting the Pyramid?
I haven't read it.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Man, it is such a, it's Sam, I know you've read it. All right. Inverting the Pyramid is a book that was put out in like 2008 by a guy named Jonathan Wilson, who is an English soccer journalist and author. And it is kind of the definitive book about soccer tactics and the history of tactics.
My defense is, as a kid in the 70s, I was kind of a soccer history nerd.
Yeah.
So I read a lot of books that, you know, combined kind of gave you that history.
Okay, that's fair.
This book is more modern, though. It's extended past the 70s, but...
Well, it does, but it really sheds a whole lot of light on the history of the game dating back to its origin days, and you learn about how, you know, in the original days of football, way back in the 1800s, you know, we talk about formations of... 4-4-2. Yeah. Well, it used to be that it was like 1-3-7 or whatever it was.
Austria's 2-3-5.
Yeah, it was crazy and all the formations back in the day. Well, that's a great book. Well, anyway, we're going to talk to Jonathan Wilson. I recorded an interview with him yesterday, and I'm going to play a little bit, about 12 minutes of it. It's really good. By the way, the book, the reason why it's kind of a thing, is the book is an Easter egg a few times over the course of the two seasons of Ted Lasso. Yeah. And his reaction about that is pretty interesting and worth that part of the interview alone is worth listening to. So we'll get to that here in a little bit. All right. When we come back, we will talk about Chelsea and City and Liverpool and all the rest of the stuff going on in the Premier League next on The Kick Around.
Ah, yes, the great soccer90.com, your place for all things U.S. national team, international club gear, and just great gift ideas for the soccer lover in your life. In fact, now, these days, they even have shin guards, guard locks, soccer balls, and other soccer equipment in stock. Of course, you can find jerseys and stuff from your favorite Premier League teams, Serie A, Bundesliga, and other European league gear. It's available now. And if you don't know what to buy specifically for your soccer-loving family member or friend, Soccer90.com offers gift cards that you can purchase on their website and give to them so they can decide how to spend your money. Good idea, isn't it? And because you're a Kick Around listener, you get 25% off at checkout when you use the promo code KICKAROUND at Soccer90.com.
It's a miracle you're not 400 pounds.
Sorry to talk food on your show, Peter.
It's your show, too. You can talk all the food you want. Wow. Hey, welcome to, yes, this is the Kick Around. Yes, it's the soccer show. I know the Soroy brothers aren't here. Good news, Mike returns on Monday. I am co-hosting mornings with him and Sean Bass for most of next week, leading up to Christmas. Yes, the Shawn Michaels morning show will return. I believe we will do the now annual phone call to Simon Soroy.
Oh,
and maybe we'll have the ticket Simon. Pop-up shop return. Yeah.
I saw them setting up the pop-up shop down the hall, so I think we'll be getting that done.
That's something to look forward to next week. So the Soroy brothers will return on a Saturday noontime jam somewhere in the near future, I'm sure. But in the meantime, Andy and I do have at least a little bit of soccer to talk about. Over our shoulders on the now infamous Ticket Studio quad display setup, in the upper left corner is Leeds hosting Arsenal.
Mm-hmm.
Leeds having to come back after getting shellacked a kajillion to nothing.
Yeah. Leeds is not in a good place. And then, I mean.
And Arsenal is already up at halftime.
Yeah.
But now it's just started the second half. It's 3-0.
Yeah.
Leeds is just leaking goals left and right.
And we haven't been able to pay too close attention to the game as, you know, we're prepping for the show. But the some of the highlights that we've seen and the run of play, their defense is just...
Well, it's just typical. I mean, first off, this is a weird game because Leeds also has a ton of injuries. They're missing all their... Mm-hmm. They're probably missing four or five of their best players.
Yeah.
And they were in the loss, the big, massive loss the other day against... Who was the... Who'd they lose 7-0 to? Was it City?
City.
Yeah, City. But Bielsa continues to insist on playing Bielsa ball, which essentially means... constantly going to score, and defense is second.
They don't have. I mean, the team is built. They trained. They've been playing like this for 4 years. What else are they going to do?
Well,
you know, they can't just dramatically shift now.
So, in the aftermath of the City game, Bielsa went on television in his post-game interview, and he was about as close to acting like a guy about to commit Harry Carey professionally as it gets, and because he's Bielsa. And he's done something like this before, you could absolutely see a scenario where he goes, look, this is all my fault. I absorb all of the blame, and I'm firing myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't think Leeds fans, by and large, want that to happen. I think they're smart enough to know that they've got a good thing going with Bielsa. But it would not surprise me, especially if this ends up being another massive select.
Let's say it's 5-0.
It would not surprise me.
Yeah, he calls it a day.
But he's also such a good-minded guy that he also may be of the mind of I can't run out on these guys now.
Yeah, right. And I still contend that they against the teams that they need to beat down near the relegation zone, they'll be okay. They're 5 points clear right now, which is not insignificant. I mean, it's 5 points, but it's still they're not in the relegation zone, right? And it's really a couple of teams that they have to stay ahead of, Watford and Burnley. I think Newcastle, Norwich are far enough away that they're okay with that. As long as they beat the teams that are near and around them, they'll be okay.
One thing to keep an eye on is that Watford and Burnley specifically have multiple games in hand.
That's the issue.
The 5-point gap is a little bit of a misnomer because of the games in hand for the teams behind
them. Except those games are against very difficult opponents, too,
perhaps.
So, but now, at the same time, the other big story here, going back a couple of weeks now, a month, is Arsenal, right? So... Yes, Leeds is not playing well. They're getting shellacked today by Arsenal, but Arsenal has been playing really well, with the exception of that loss against the other team from Liverpool.
The worst team in Liverpool.
Yeah, Arsenal's had a very good run, not even more than a month, 2 months now. Enough so that they are top four. Arsenal is now top four. If the season ended today, Arsenal is in Champions League.
Yeah, it's
and who would have thunk that the way they started, right?
No, you're 100% correct, and it has been things have definitely felt better. The Aubameyang situation is one of those deals where I guess I read today that he's been told that until he gets back from the African Cup of Nations, he's essentially not playing, which definitely sets it up as some sort of his time at the club is over, which is weird because he was the team captain and now he's been stripped of the captaincy because he was just he's at a string of really weird incidents that don't look good if you're the captain of a club.
They're not. The last one, though, the one that really was the end all for the gaffer was that he went to visit his mom in France and was supposed to come back the night before to then be available for training that next morning. He didn't come back till that morning, but he was still available for training that morning. So that seems kind of funny, but maybe it was just the last straw.
Well, my sense is that he broke the rule on top of a whole bunch of other things are going on, and they're like, yeah, we've had enough. Like, you're trying to make a point, or you're trying to get away with something. You're already in the doghouse, and you might as well just stay there. And you know what? It's okay, because they've looked good. They've got so much great young talent on that team. Mm-hmm. It's weird today to me, and this is where I think this is a good sign, that they go to Leeds and they sit Smith Rowe, who's probably now my favorite player in the Premier League currently, at least in this particular moment, and they sit him. Right, they play Xhaka and Partey and Odegaard as a midfield three, and they're doing great. They didn't need Smith Rowe, so that's a very Pep Guardiola kind of attitude in terms of sitting players, giving them a rest, and showing what kind of depth that you actually may have on your roster, and it's working out for them today.
Yeah, the other thing that this little crisis with the player did for the coach as well is I think it could have gone two ways. He could have lost the players, or it could have caused a little bit of an issue with the players in the locker room, and it did the opposite. I think they respect them more now. You know, he showed, hey, you know, there's no except, no matter who you are the rules, and I think they appreciated that. And so he's kind of united the team a little bit as well with this. So
that said, I have no idea if Arsenal is a legit contender to finish in the top four. I don't really know. Long
let's
term.
Let's analyze that, though, because, I mean, there are three teams going to get the top three spots, City, Liverpool, and Chelsea, right? So now you have four legit teams vying for that one spot. It's Arsenal, the Hammers, United, and Spurs.
Right. Yep.
So does anybody stand out much more above the others than, you know?
No.
They're all kind of like, you can make a case for any of them.
You absolutely could make a case for all of those. And the other story I wanted to get into is kind of the odd shifting of the sand for Chelsea of late, because Tuchel obviously came in as a coach last year, took over for Lampard, had massive success, took him and won the Champions League, and started the season looking very good. You and I both picked them to win the Premiership. Mm-hmm. I think by and large everybody now believes that it's really City's to lose. Mm-hmm. They look too good. Mm-hmm. Also,
Liverpool looks really good and consistent.
But Chelsea in particular has been interesting, because now they've gone through kind of a flat spell. Mm-hmm. The defensive success they've had has fallen off. They've given up way too many goals of late. The result the other day was not what they were. Was it Everton?
Yep,
right?
The
Everton game was a really disappointing result. I do wonder, though, about Christian Pulisic, who started the Everton game. Mm-hmm. They played him as a false nine. Then they moved him out to the wing. And I got to tell you, man, I'm really worried about Christian, because every time I see him of late, whether it's at Chelsea or the United States, and a lot of this is because he's been injured and not playing regularly, is he looks like a kid that's just trying too hard.
Mm. He probably is pressing. He probably is.
He's not passing the ball enough.
Yeah. I didn't watch that game. When he played as a false nine, was he moved because he just wasn't effective as a false nine? Because originally that was going to be his position coming into this season, remember?
Yeah, and it's weird because I think Mason Mount is a much better player of that position, mm-hmm. and playing wide is more natural for Pulisic. Mm-hmm. It's a weird decision on Tuchel's part to do that. I'm sure there's a good reason for it, but pushing him out wide was just because he was making changes elsewhere and needing people to go places. And he got a full 90 minutes out of Christian Pulisic, but largely ineffective. And I don't know, man. I don't know how long his career stays at Chelsea, or if he's going to have to go find someplace else. You know, as Lukaku and Mount and all those other guys kind of round out form, I just don't know where Christian Pulisic fits in all there, at least on a regular basis.
And they'll go get more firepower after the season as well. The tough thing for Chelsea now, if they're for their title hopes, the tough thing is that they have two teams to overcome, City and Liverpool. They have to get past both of those. And that's tough. It's already hard for the team in second to get past that first team, right? Because you got to get a result, and there's some that goes against the other team. Chelsea needs for City and Liverpool both to stumble at some point down the line. It's going to be tough.
Very quietly, well, maybe not quietly, so that's probably not the right word, to watch is what is going on at Manchester United with Ragnick as the new manager, and the shifting sands of what's going to happen to that roster. Martial, Rashford, Greenwood, Pogba, Cavani, all these guys, suddenly now their status within the club is very much in question with the windows coming up.
But you think it's going to happen like immediately this window?
I think there will be some surprises. I don't think a lot of them, but okay. I do think there are surprises to come in January because he's so famous for playing young up-and-coming players, which United has a ton of really interesting young attacking players to choose from that are probably all willing to, you know, run their ass off.
Like Greenwood?
Even younger, like the next level down, and Elanga, those guys.
Yeah, okay.
There's some really interesting young talent on that team. Now, they're not experienced, but they'll do what Ragnick wants, and some of these other guys may not be up for it. Ronaldo's another one. Yeah. Like, what happens to him? Yeah. So just keep your eyes out.
I just thought this was a period of assessment for him through May.
Yeah.
Before next season.
Well, we'll keep everybody posted. Three big games still on the docket tomorrow to be played, which, you know, is anybody's guess as to whether or not they actually happen. It does feature the top three teams in the league. So Newcastle is hosting Man City, Wolves is hosting Chelsea, and Spurs is hosting Liverpool. At least as at this moment, those games are on. We don't know. Things are shifting. You'll just want to keep up on the Twitter or on social media or online just to find out tomorrow morning when you wake up. All right. When we come back, we're going to dial up our friend Daniel Robertson to talk all about Serie A next here on the Kick Around. Welcome back to the Kick Around. We're filling in for the Sorori boys a couple of hours earlier from our normal slot. I don't know. We're obviously off Christmas Day, New Year's Day. Andy, Boxing Day is next weekend on Sunday. There's, at least at this point in time, a slate of games to be played.
Chuck,
in the Premier League.
Who knows what'll get played?
Are you and I going to record a post-Boxing Day podcast for the P1s?
Well, if there's games to watch and if I can watch and things like that.
Okay. All right. Well, we've done a lot of Premier League talking, but it is time now to dial up on the Buyer's Barricade hotline our good friend, American-Italian Daniel Robertson. Hello, Daniel.
Gentlemen, buongiorno. Come stai?
You're actually in no way, shape, or form Italian at all, other than the fact that you lived in Italy for a short period of time, correct?
Correct, 100%. And it was actually, you know, you always dream about being able to speak a language that other people don't know that you can understand them when they're talking. So the last, like, 3 or 4 months that I was in Italy was great when I could understand what they were saying about me, and they really had no idea.
All right. Well, good. Well, Daniel is always on the show to help us understand better the things going on in Italy and Serie A in particular, and also help us pronounce all the names of teams and players that we can't, because that's not our forte here. But the one thing, since it is the holiday season, Daniel, since we asked you to do this role for us, the one thing I've been looking forward to as a gift to the P1 is to give you the opportunity to tell the story of seeing Italian goalkeeper extraordinaire Buffon do something interesting. So would you please share that story with the good P1s?
Yes, let's tell this great story around Christmas time, gather around the fire. I started out at Juventus in July 2017, and we were just about 3 weeks after I started. We headed back to the United States for our American preseason tour. Imagine that. We haven't had one of those in a couple of years, but we were playing, I think, Barcelona at MetLife Stadium, PSG in Miami, and then Roma at Gillette Stadium in Boston. And so I had been there for about 3 weeks. I knew zero Italian. I was trying to be a fly on the wall, really didn't want anyone to know who I was, and really had no idea even what was going on. So we get to the airport for our flight to New York, and it was a jetliner that I'd never seen before, in the sense that it had first class lay flat seats from the front to the back of the plane. So like you would see, normally the first 20 rows, first class, this was the entire plane. I didn't know those existed.
Was it a charter?
So it was a full charter. And they had the players at the front, kind of team technical staff in the middle, and then us plebs in the back, still with our lay flat seats though. And there was a couch behind me, which I'll get to in a second. There was like kind of, I was maybe like the last or next to last row of the plane.
That sounds so salacious, by the way.
Yeah.
The sofa.
So there's an open area and a couch behind me, and I'm kind of like, well, why is that there?
But well, I can tell you.
Anyways, yeah. So plane takes off. We're about an hour into the flight, and anyone who has been to Italy knows that Italians like to smoke. And there's no real limits to it. It's still, to this day, I would say 75-80% of Italians either smoke or vape or something along those lines.
And yes, I will tell you, I agree. I don't think the only other place in the world I've been to where people smoke as much, if not more, than Italians is Kentucky.
Okay. All right.
True. I don't. That's not a joke. That's okay. Literally. I mean, they smoke an insane amount of cigarettes in Italy. It's bonkers.
Well, and the smoke breaks in the office. I mean, I thought about picking up smoking just because everyone's getting a break and I'm still sitting at my desk working. You know, they're all taking smoke breaks every hour. But anyway, so it's about an hour into the flight and I'm kind of just dozing off or whatever. And then Gigi Buffon literally gets up and walks back behind me. And I'm thinking to myself, like, what's going on here? There's nothing at the back of the plane. Like, why is he back here?
Gigi Buffon being the legendary goalkeeper of the national team.
Yes. I mean, probably like,
the
most
persona here is important.
Juventus player, yeah. The most recognizable Italian
right.
soccer player.
World Cup winning Buffon. Exactly.
Yes. Okay. So right. Larger than life. Figure.
Yes.
So
okay.
I'm sitting there. I'm thinking, do I try to snap a photo to send back to my friends? No, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to get fired. 3 weeks into the job. So I don't even look back at him. But then about 2 minutes later, I start smelling something and it's cigarette smoke. And I'm just like, this was my, you're not in Kansas anymore moment. You know, this was because I'm used to flying with SC Dallas. Okay. Flying commercial with people asking Kellen Acosta, like, hey, who are you?
Are you guys a youth soccer team?
Yeah, which has happened.
What tournament are you guys playing in?
Yeah, which has happened before. So Gigi's, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, man, Allegri's going to be mad. Like, what is he doing? And then he lights up. And that was basically like everyone on the plane was waiting for Gigi to light up. And then they all,
point,
probably like, 60% of the plane. Other players are coming back there, the veteran players, not the young players. Veteran players are coming back there. They all start lighting up. And Allegri's back just like talking to some of his – he's 10 feet away from them, so obviously he doesn't care. He's not smoking. But I – and then they, of course, all go back up to the front of the plane, and I'm left with the like pigpen-style cloud of smoke just hovering around my head for the rest of the flight.
At 35,000 feet.
Oh, like the old days when you could smoke on a commercial flight.
Yeah, well, Danny, you're too young to remember the old days, but that's what flying was like back in the golden age of travel.
The non-smoking and the smoking section. Well, it's actually a smoking section and a kind of people not actually smoking in the section, but the smoke wafting over to the non-smoking section.
Yeah. That's right. So, yeah, that was my you're not in Kansas anymore moment. Things are a little bit different over here, and they do their own thing.
Did you ask him for if you could bum a cigarette?
You know, I didn't. My boss, this kind of grizzled old 50-year-old Italian guy, he smoked these mini cigars, and he would smoke three of them every single day. He had this little pack, and he would smoke three of these mini cigars every day. So I thought about asking for him for one time, maybe as a bonding experience. But no, I didn't ask Gigi for a Marlboro Red.
Yeah, Daniel, I'm not a smoker either, but if I had an opportunity to smoke a butt with Buffon on an airplane, that may have been the opportunity I would have taken. Up, but that's an awesome story. All right, so what is the latest in Serie A? I saw today that Weston McKennie is finally back from his knee injury with Juve, speaking of which, and is going to play if he hasn't. I don't know when that game is.
It's already over.
He did play today, Daniel. Can you give us a report on the Juve game that happened today, please, sir?
Yeah, in the dense fog of Bologna, they secured a 2-0 win, unless something happened in the last minute or two. They secured a 2-0 win. Weston played 75 minutes. Actually played really, really well. Didn't show any signs of trouble. Juve has one more game on, I believe, Tuesday or Wednesday before the Serie A takes a winter break for about 3 weeks. Perfect timing for him to come back, get a few minutes under his legs, and then probably take a couple weeks slowly. If I were the U.S. fan, I wouldn't be worried at all. He looked great.
Okay.
Juve needed the win, And yeah, important 3 points. Sorry, Sam, but an important 3 points over Bologna.
Are they having the same COVID issues in Italy that they're having in England currently?
Yeah, that's a great question. And no, actually, now I don't know if that's related to testing or if that's actually related to just Italians have been really, really good about getting vaccinations and boosters and those sorts of things. There's not really a stigma around that in Italy. So I would say that's part of it. But there hasn't been any real COVID situations, which, you know, you love to see.
Do you know if the vaccination rate amongst Serie A players is higher than it is in Premier League, which is like at the 60-something%?
That's a great question. I'd have to look into that, but I do know that just in general, the stigma, basically Italy has made it in general in public where you pretty much can't do anything without having a vaccination.
Okay.
Yeah. Double boosters, 65%.
Yeah, exactly.
65% in the EPL, above 85% in Serie A.
Oh, well, that's very low.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, Daniel, I'm scared.
I'm
scared because Liverpool has drawn Inter, and so I decided to catch a little Inter in action, and they whipped up on a team. I know this team is not very good that they beat Salernitana, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Inter looked really good. Are they really that good?
Yeah, and what you should be scared about is Inter's not allowing any goals right now. It's been, I believe, 6 games in a row in Serie A without a goal allowed. Okay, they dropped a result to Madrid in the Champions League where they had nothing on the line. And if you give an Italian team a game with nothing on the line, they're going to lose. But they've Salernitana 5-0, 4-0 over Cagliari, 3-0 over Roma, 2-0 over Spezia, 2-0 over Venezia. That's their last 5 Serie A results. They're not allowing goals. And listen, I've said this name before on the show, Edin Dzeko, a guy who longtime Premier League fans will know the name from his exploits at Man City. This guy has been reborn, giving hope to 35-year-olds like me all around the world that we can still have some sporting success. He's playing they sold Lukaku to Chelsea, obviously. They basically bought Dzeko on a free transfer from Inter. Or from Roma, excuse me, and he's playing just about every minute right now. He's got 8 goals in the league, and he's just opening things up. He's a perfect foil to Lautaro Martinez, the Argentine forward. He's playing just about every minute now, even at his age. And Inter right now, boy, they're going to be tricky for this is not one. This is going to be a 1-0 game either way. As long as everyone stays healthy, it's going to be a very tough matchup for Liverpool.
And then I also saw today that Roma and Jose Mourinho beat Atalanta at Atalanta. And the surprise of this game is the score is 4-1. Roma wins 4-1, but they only had the ball less than 30% of the game. Is that Mourinho's dream result?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's enjoying a nice Chianti tonight for sure. You know, he's probably already listening to the show with a glass of red wine.
Oh, I'm sure.
Listening to our show? Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
no doubt.
Sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so listening to us. But, yeah, that's exactly, you know, Roma's turning it around a little bit. They've had some good results in both the Europa Conference League, and then they've beaten Spezia. They got the win over Atalanta. They're creeping towards Champions League spot again. Tammy Abraham, another name that Premier League fans who listen to the show will know. He scored 2 goals today. They bought him from Chelsea in the offseason. He's having a really nice year for them. He's really integrating into the league very well. And, yeah, if you're Roma, you almost don't like the winter pause right now. They're playing some really good football. And yeah, I mean, a 4-1 win at Atalanta. Not many teams go to Atalanta and win by 3 goals. So that's a really good sign if you're a Roma fan. And yeah, exactly what Mourinho wants.
Hey, that team that Inter played, Salernitana? Mm-hmm. They're from Salerno. They're really bad. Are they shady in terms of ownership? Why are they playing in Serie A?
Yeah, so this is a big another controversy in Serie A right now. So Salernitana, who is from Salerno, if you've ever been to Naples, that's one of the teams in the one of the cities on the Amalfi Coast. I believe there's a restaurant kind of near me, Salerno as well. If you've ever been there, but they have 8 points from 18 games. They haven't scored in like 6 games. And the problem is they're owned by Claudio Lotito, who owns Lazio as well. And in Serie A, you can't have 2 owners. So, and so he placed, you know, just like our fine politicians place their stocks into blind trusts, and of course they have nothing to do with them. Latito placed Salernitana into a blind trust, and they were supposed to be sold by December 31st or risk getting kicked out of the league. So that is what the issue is right now. They kind of need to sell the team in the next 2 weeks, or potentially by the letter of the law, they should be kicked out of Serie A. Watch this space to see what happens there. Of course, they're probably going to get relegated anyways. I'm sure plenty of teams would love that 3 points in the second half of the season and hope they don't get relegated automatically. But yeah, it's a sticky situation down in Salerno.
Salerno, olive oil and lemons, man.
Italian soccer is also always very unstable and always highly entertaining for that reason. All right, the great Daniel Robertson. Thanks, man. Happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and all that stuff to you and your family, our friend.
Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
All right, we will speak to you soon. All right, when we come back, a special holiday treat. We talk to the great author of Inverting the Pyramid, Jonathan Wilson, next here on The Kick Around. Oh, no, we don't. What's next?
I think we're talking MLS next.
Oh, sorry, I got ahead of myself. Oh, yes.
Follow the run sheet.
Audible. We talk MLS next. All right, well, I inaccurately promoted it, but I will do it again. A little talk with Jonathan Wilson, the author of Inverting the Pyramid, the great soccer tactics book, is coming up here in just a few minutes. And by the way, if you're not paying attention, South Oak Cliff is playing in the state championship in American high school football.
American.
And I'm rooting for them. Seriously, they are tied currently at the start of the fourth quarter, 14-14. They're about to kick a field goal, and it goes in. And so they're ahead 17-14. There you go. There's your update. All right, so we haven't been doing a live kick-around show for a while due to the station's commitment with all of the bowl games and NFL Saturday games, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't even know if we probably – no. In fact, definitely will not be doing another live kick-around until after the first of the year.
And maybe even a little deeper than that.
We're filling in for the Sorois today. But we have been doing podcast versions of the kick-around, and you can find those on our website, thekickaround.com, for all that content. And last week – was it last week?
Mm-hmm.
Last week, we did a podcast, which largely was filled with content with our friend here, my buddy, my soccer talking BFF, Andy, live from Portland, Oregon, as you were in attendance.
Reporting from Portland.
Reporting live on the scene
right.
For your 26th
yes.
MLS Cup.
Right.
As I designated you then, and will repeat here because I think it's such a smart line, you are Major League Soccer's version of Lamar Hunt's widow.
Right. Who's attended every Super Bowl, right?
Who's been to every Super Bowl.
So 26 out of 26. There's still five of us, I think, left.
Did you get the email I forwarded you?
Yes, I did. And then I connected with him on Twitter, but after the event. This is one of the – in fact, we kind of met through Twitter last year. It's one of the other ones that have been to everyone.
Yeah, we got a letter via our website from somebody who had heard us talking about you being going to – and I guess he's been to all of the games,
yeah,
too.
Right, yeah, him and his friend. So with me, that's three. One other employee at MLS, Mark Abbott, a very important employee who wrote the business plan for MLS and deputy commissioner. He's the other one. He's the fifth. So, but yeah, we hope to connect at next MLS Cup. God willing, we'll all be there.
So Portland is the greatest of all the soccer atmospheres in the United States, isn't it?
It's if not top three, you know, I mean, it's...
Well, I don't know if there's a better soccer atmosphere in this country.
Yeah, Kansas City, you know, it gets pretty good there in Atlanta. Part of it is how smart are the fans, but how engaged is the totality of the stadium throughout, right? Because we have stadiums that have really kick-ass supporter sections and big supporter sections, and they're engaged throughout the game.
LAFC would be a great one.
But the rest of the stadium, perhaps not as much. What you get in Portland is a really, really big and voluminous supporter section, but the rest of the stadium is engaged with the section, with the supporters, in terms of the singing and the chanting, and just following the game play-by-play. Right?
Mm-hmm.
They're very intelligent in terms of the... I think Seattle. We got to give
Seattle's good. Kansas City's good.
Where the totality of the stadium isn't.
Yeah, there are certainly other stadiums that have good atmospheres. Yeah. Portland's just the creme de la creme.
Yeah, right. And the thing about Portland, their stadium is an old minor league baseball stadium that they renovated and made into a soccer-specific stadium, basically. I mean, it is now the soccer stadium, Providence Park. And they've recently renovated and expanded it. I think it went from 18,000 seats to like 25, maybe. So it's a little bit nicer, but it's still an older-ish stadium. And you know what? It's still amazing to attend a game there. The sight lines are great. And because we have a lot of new soccer-specific stadiums now being built around the country, very modern. The one in Austin, it's great. It's wonderful to watch games from those new stadiums. But there's something to be said about this old little stadium in Portland that doesn't have to have be ultra-modern, and it's still great to watch a game from there.
I would say this, and because I'm assuming there may be some people listening that thought they were tuning into Cirque du Soleil that are just sports fans, and I would say that Portland's Providence Park is the one soccer experience that I would recommend any just general American sports fan go experience if they have the if they're given the opportunity. You don't need to know anything about the sport. If you just want an amazing atmosphere to experience that, that's the place to go and do it. It really is unlike pretty much anything else you're going to get. It's almost like a really, really good college football game kind of atmosphere.
Yeah, very similar. And if you visit Portland, you're likely going to stay downtown. That's where most of the hotels are. And it's a 15-minute walk from downtown.
Yeah, it's super cool.
Yep.
It is for sure. Well, it was a great MLS Cup. One of the running storylines that we continue to talk about is the pending outcome of their next media deal. This is like the big thing that is really important to the success long-term of this league. They're adding a 29th club next year in Charlotte. Comes online, and they've got a 30th. Right? That's actually, I take that back. Excuse me. Charlotte is the 28th team. St. Louis will be the 29th team.
Correct.
And it appears that Vegas will end up being the 30th
the front
team.
Runner
yeah,
now.
The front runners for that now.
For now.
And so whatever this next media deal is really important. You know, I've been very pessimistic about what this deal looks like. In terms of dollar value, currently they're getting, what, $90 million a year for their deal with Fox and ESPN. There's lots of discussions about where this is going to go. And the MLS Cup last week ended up getting, it depending on which numbers you're looking at, if it's just the ABC numbers or if you're looking at the combined totality, it's still a total viewership of like no more than 1.5 million, which isn't a bad number for the league, but it's not an outstanding number for viewership of sports television in general.
Right. While attendance has grown in MLS over the last 10 years, and you know the values of the franchises have grown, the merchandising sales, that has grown. Eyeballs just watching the game in the U.S., that has grown. The one issue still with MLS, the toughest thing that they've had to do is they haven't figured out how to really grow the television eyeball numbers as much as they want.
Yeah.
And, you know, but part of it is just the way we consume and the way those younger than us consume sports moving forward is going to be different. Now, one thing they are talking about doing in future years or with this next contract is to bundle the regional telecast as well with the national.
Yeah, currently all the teams locally work out their own deals. So here in Dallas, we get Mark Folwell and Steve Davis on an FC Dallas done production here locally. But now if they wrap everything in, I think what they're trying to do is make it so that you can watch whatever game. Kind of like NFL Sunday Ticket.
Right.
Yeah, that kind
of
deal.
The current setup is like Major League Baseball. You have your one-off game of the week or a couple games of the week, and then all the other games are regional. They want to move to the NFL model, which is the league controls all the broadcasts.
Well, it's to be determined. My feeling is, and again, I'm kind of talking out my butt because there's a lot of details. Because the existing deal now also includes all of the rights for the U.S. men's national team home games, and in this next deal, that will be lost.
That'll
go
away.
Now, what will be included again are the regional games and also this new Major League Soccer 2 second division that they're building for the reserve teams.
Yeah, so the numbers have gone up a little bit. They it's not like they've been
total
flat.
Number of games numbers or viewership
numbers for national games have creeped up, not gone up a lot, creeped up. So that's growing a little bit. So you have that. If you bundle in regional, what happens is at a regional level, teams are not getting the rights fee. Like, some teams do get decent rights fees, few of them. A lot of teams actually pay for the broadcast, and they do a deal with whatever carrier for the time. The league is thinking, if we bring all that in-house, package it all together, teams are going to get more money from the revenue rights being split, because they're going to get more dollars selling it as a bundle.
But my question is, if just using a round number, if the current deal gives MLS $90 million a year, do you think that number jumps to $180 million a year, or is less, or what percentage?
Because you're going to add digital rights as well. And remember, the World Cup is coming. So they're going to tie it into because the World Cup is coming. It's going to heighten what people want to pay for soccer, whether TV rights or sponsorships with soccer properties or whatever, right? Dollars spent in soccer, in the soccer industry, that's going to go up over the next 5 years because the World Cup is coming. And then whatever tie-in that they can, whatever they can do to tie in the World Cup, and not just the World Cup, their new deal with the Liga MX. I mean, the Liga MX partnership is going to also factor into the revenue that they can get for this TV deal. And they have this new tournament, right, that they're playing with Liga MX.
Yeah.
So they're hoping that creates
It is very telling that if you look at the viewership numbers between MLS Cup and the Liga MX final that happened the other day against Atlas and was it Lyon? I think it were Lyon. Yeah. The Liga MX numbers were more than double, I think, of the MLS Cup final.
Yeah, and those were two teams that don't even draw as much as if it was Tigres or America. Right,
yeah, exactly. And MLS Cup featured market number one in New York City.
So this is why MLS is really gung-ho to really partner even more with Liga MX, because if they can bring some of those eyeballs into the sphere of dollars.
They're merging at some point. Yes, it may not happen soon. It may happen after 2026, but they are going to merge.
But that's related. The build-up to that and the steps to get to that point, that's all part of this new TV deal, right? And so this is where the dollars are going to come from.
All right. And also, since the last time we talked, Dallas has finally announced a new coach. It is Nico Estevez. Is it Estevez or Estevez? Do you know? The accent is in the middle of his last name.
Estevez,
right? Okay, that's what I thought. So Nico last was the assistant coach under Greg Berhalter. This is such an unstable scenario. Dallas fires Luchi Gonzalez, hires the assistant coach at the U.S. men's national team, Nico Estevez. Luchi's new gig is Nico Estevez's former job under Greg Berhalter.
They basically swapped places. And you're getting somebody like Luchi, right?
I mean,
a similar credentials, although I think a little bit more experience, perhaps, right? Because he has the experience of coaching in Valencia in Spain.
But Luchi has 2.5 seasons of coaching, being a manager of a Major League Soccer team that Nico Estevez does not have.
Yeah,
it's a weird situation. I have no idea how it's going to work out. But they've got a lot of other things they're working on. They got the Ricardo Pepi. You know, are they going to sell him? The club has been very vocal and open about their intentions of trying to keep him for next season. He's in all of their season ticket sales packages. Promoting him is going to be here.
Yeah.
Pepe's people are saying, no, we're already getting offers from clubs all over the world. We want to go. Nobody's really sure where Ricardo's head is in that.
I don't think he goes this winter season. I think he goes in the summer if he goes before World
Cup. I think he's gone.
I don't know.
I could drag on about this all. Yeah. By the way, speaking of that, Ricardo is with the national team. They do actually have a friendly game tonight. It's at 7 p.m. on Fox Sports 1. The U.S. men's national team is playing Bosnia-Herzegovina. It's filled with a bunch of really young characters by large part. There's a ton of guys in there you may never even heard of before, but there's also a lot of really exciting talent that you may get to see tonight. So if you happen to not have anything else to watch tonight, at 7 p.m. on Fox Sports 1, the U.S. men's national team and Bosnia are going to go at it. All right, when we come back, I will promote it again. Author of Inverting the Pyramid, Jonathan Wilson, will join us here on The Kick Around. Welcome back to The Kick Around. Yes, we are sitting in for the Saroy brothers today. And by the way, if you're driving around and you're wondering, South Oak Cliff is leading Liberty Hill late in the fourth quarter and driving for a touchdown. They're already up 23-14. They scored a touchdown and then recovered a fumble on the ensuing kickoff. And they're essentially just going to wear this game out and win the first state championship in football for DISD since 1958. And as a lifelong Dallas resident, I think that's about as cool as it gets. And I'm super proud and super happy. So I'm sure Jacob will have more on that here coming up in a little bit. All right. Andy, I know you've not read the book, mm-hmm. but I know you're familiar with Inverting the Pyramid. Sam's read the book. If you're a soccer fan and really interested in understanding the history of mm-hmm. tactics and formation, that may sound dry and weird, but Jonathan Wilson's book, Inverting the Pyramid, is really almost the current day Bible. It was published in 2008. I think there's been a couple of updates since mm-hmm. then. Wilson's actually written a bunch of other books. He's got a novel coming out about a Russian player that's coming out and available here soon. He talks about it. Yesterday, I was able to record an interview with him. Now, here's the deal. The entire interview is almost 30 minutes long. Oh. I've pared it down for this broadcast to just the stuff that I think people will really care about. Later on, I will post the entire interview as a standalone thing on our podcast, which you'll be able to find wherever you get your podcast or on our website, thekickaround.com. But anyway, for your entertainment, here is the great Jonathan Wilson talking about his book and more about football on The Kick Around. Well, thanks for joining us, Jonathan Wilson. I have to add, right off the top, do you go by Jonathan, John, Wilson? I've heard you called so many different things. What would you, I don't know what you'd like me to call you or refer to you as.
Just go with Jonathan. Yeah. Right. It's just at the Guardian, like everybody's called Jonathan. So, so we tend to be referred to as by surnames to differentiate us.
Okay. Well, Jonathan, thanks for joining the Kick Around. I don't know if you have any, I mean, how aware are you of the popularity of Inverting the Pyramid as a book for people, especially here in the States where there's so many people that are new to the game and learning about the game?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've seen the sales figures, which are great, and I've seen the checks I get as a result of that, which are even better. And yeah, I have to say, I was slightly surprised that it made the appearances in Ted Lasso. But I guess that's very flattering. And I think even the final episode of the second season was the title of that episode was something to do with Inverting the Pyramid. So I guess that means it has a traction and recognizability.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I was going to get into that later on in a later question, but I'll just start there. So you had no awareness that your book was going to make kind of Easter egg appearances in Ted Lasso. You had no forewarning about that?
No, not a clue. No.
And you haven't received any benefit? Like they didn't pay you for the appearance other than the residual book sales, I suppose.
I mean, I'm pretty sure there have been residual book sales, but no, there's been absolutely no contact between me and them.
Okay, so I have to know. So what is that existence? What is that experience like for you? Are you just sitting at home one day and somebody goes, "Hey, mate, your book's on this new TV show I'm watching about an American soccer coach"?
Pretty much, yeah. Suddenly got a load of messages on Twitter. People I don't even know saying, "Oh, look, your book's on this new show," and it's okay. That's nice.
Well, that has to kind of change your perspective of what the book means then, because so for writers to throw your book in to kind of passively suggest it's some sort of Bible or journal about soccer tactics or football tactics, I does that change your feelings about what you produced as a piece of content?
I suppose it does. I mean, I hadn't really given it that much thought, but yeah, I mean, it's obviously very flattering that it has that sort of, that it has that instant recognizability that people know what that symbolizes.
So I guess the question that follows up is, because the book was written in 2008, what I'm interested in your perspective is how much is the introduction, because of a new digital age, of the heavy reliance on stats and everybody talking about XG and this and that and all of this stat stuff that really has come to dominate not just soccer but all sports in the last 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the new frontier. And to be honest, it's very difficult to get a handle on what difference that's making, because clubs, I think quite understandably, I think there's almost an arms race going on and they don't really want to reveal exactly what they're doing. But I mean, clearly data, when handled well, gives you insights that just having scouts watching games can't give you. And I think particularly in terms of patterns of pressing, That's an incredibly powerful tool. And if you look at the very best teams, you look at Manchester City or Liverpool, and look at the way they press and how specifically targeted that is on each opponent, you can't do that unless you have the data. So I think that is making a huge difference.
How much, there's a lot of spending differences just in the Premier League, as an example. And speaking about the ability of clubs to manage stats, is there still, even in 2021, a vast difference between how Man City or Liverpool is managing stats and integrating them in versus, let's use Newcastle as an example, or Crystal Palace, or one of the mid-table or lower-table teams?
I mean, the truth is we don't really know, because clubs don't like to talk about it. That's something that they can keep hidden away. But I suspect that, I think there was a time when the clubs who were using data cleverly were getting a competitive advantage. And I think we've seen that with, for instance, Brentford. And I think you've seen even this season that they play in a very smart way. I think their recruitment is very smart. And that is stats driven. But I suspect maybe we're already at that point, but certainly in 5-10 years, the big clubs will just be able to afford the best stats people. And so in the same way, you can afford the best centre forward and afford the best coach and afford the best groundsman, and it'll just enhance their advantage even further.
Do you have a particular period of tactical fathom a period of time where the game was played a particular way that's your favorite?
I think the most fascinating time, and I guess it's partly because it's tantalizingly out of reach. I think that switch I've just been talking about between the old football and the new, that what was happening in the early 60s, the coming of pressing. If I could go back in a time machine to watch any period of football, it would be then, because I just love to see that in action, that incredibly radical change. You look back at newspapers of the time, and nobody really understood what was going on at all. In particular, the coverage of England and 1966 World Cup, English journalists, English fans just didn't get what Ramsey was doing. They didn't get how radical it was. And I sort of had this realization, 5 years ago, that the change in English football from WM to a back four is an incredibly radical change. The revolution happens in real time, and one club after another slowly kind of adopts this. And so, I went through a list of who was playing fullback for all these clubs, because fullback was the position that changed the most. And there's only three I could find who were still alive, and none of them could remember anything. They were too old to remember. And I just wish I'd had that idea 10 years ago rather than 5 years ago, and maybe I could have got people to tell me what that was actually like. But unfortunately, I fear that's gone.
So I guess my next question is there a growing change in the game that either A, excites you, or B, worries you?
I think it's sort of slightly tangential to tactics. But I think the thing that's most worrying at the minute is the gulf between the rich and the not so rich, that group of maybe a dozen super clubs who are way ahead of the rest. Yeah, so it's a problem football has that, if you win, you get the prize money, and also more people want to watch you, and more people want to watch you means you get more revenue through gate receipts, through broadcasting revenue, sponsorship, merchandising, advertising. And then you have more money, so you can buy better players, you win more, so the cycle just goes round and it self-perpetuates. And for a long time in football, it didn't really matter, because in England up to 1961, we had a salary cap, so having loads of money just didn't really make any difference, because you couldn't spend it. Yeah, so up to 1981, 25% of gate receipts were given to the away club, so having a big stadium was beneficial, but not that beneficial. But since that was abolished in 81, the rich have just got richer. And also you've had the influx of TV rights, which has changed it radically. And I think the reason England has been able to maintain a big four, a big six, or a big three, depending exactly where you draw the line, is that we do have, compared to Spain or Italy or Germany or France, a relatively equitable distribution of TV rights. But even that's changing. The overseas rights used to be split absolutely equally, and that's ended. And you've seen in Germany, Bayern have won or are going to win 10 in a row. You had Juve won 9 in a row in Italy. Barcelona, Real Madrid dominating in Spain. PSG dominating in France. And that's just not healthy. And where that impinges on tactics is if you dominate your domestic league, absolutely, you don't need to defend. And I think that's why in the Champions League, in the last stage of the Champions League, in recent years, we've seen so many wild swings in games because big teams have forgotten what defending is. And so they get under pressure and they just buckle. And you've seen that with Barcelona over and over and over again.
That is very true and a really good point, which leads me to this question, which is with all the kind of weird changes, the, you know, World Cups every 2 years, the Super League concept, all of these things, do you have any hope that the game has a positive future moving ahead? Or like so many other things going on in the world, it's just going to become another business-oriented first kind of thing?
I really don't know. I mean, it's for somebody who, and I, you know, I'm slightly aware that I'm speaking from a very privileged English perspective. I grew up with a big club in an industrial city who aren't very good, but in terms of Sunderland, but they really represent the city, and so that level of connection is very profound, and it's a huge part of my identity. And I realize that, you know, if you live in the US or live in India or live in Nigeria or wherever, you want to support a Premier League team and you don't necessarily have that connection. But I guess it is the nature of globalization that business draws things away from their communities, and there's benefits to that, but there's also significant downsides. So I'd be lying if I said there wasn't part of me thinks a massive crash in football might not be the worst thing.
So you mentioned your fandom of Sunderland, and for me personally, the Netflix series Sunderland Till I Die is really critically important and good because it does such a good job of communicating that connection that you talk about in ways that are very unusual here in the United States. But I do wonder from your perspective, since you are a fan of the club that has been through all of that crazy on-field kind of, I don't know what you want to call it, just poorness. Do you enjoy the series at all, or is that something you repel from because it tells such a sad story of your favorite club?
No, I think it's brilliant, and I think it's done with such love for the club and love for the city. So the lads who made it were 3 years below me at school, so I'm not going to claim they're great mates, but you know, I know them slightly. But their affection for the place is absolutely genuine. I think you see that in those lingering drone shots of the cliffs, which is exactly where I grew up. So, and I think the people, the fans they got, the people at the club, I think it was very good at expressing what the club means to a declining city. So I thought it was a really, really great insight into the club, but also into the area. And I find it very moving.
Jonathan Wilson, I appreciate you taking the time and fighting through all the technical stuff that you and I have been back and forth on for the last 30 minutes. But I will ask you one more question, which is, who is the most interesting or surprising person that you have either directly or indirectly found out read Inverting the Pyramid and had something good or bad to say about it?
Well, I mean, there's two sort of stand out. So there was Craig Levine, who was briefly, he was very successful at Hearts, and he had quite a disappointing time in charge of Scotland. And the great disaster of his reign was picking a 4-6-0 against the Czech Republic. And I think Scotland lost 1-0, but played abysmally. And he was getting hammered in a press conference, and he started defending it by reference to Inverting the Pyramid, saying, no, strikelessness is a future. I read this book, and I was like, oh, God, I mean, I hope I'm not going to get blamed for this. And then the other person was David Pleat, who you may remember was manager of Luton when they avoided relegation in 1983, and then he became manager of Tottenham. And he still does quite a bit of co-commentary on radio. And I can't remember where I was, but I was at a luggage carousel in an airport, and he came up to me and, you're the broker out of the book, aren't you? Yes, I am. Yeah. Well, yeah, what you said about the five midfield and how Everton pioneered, actually it was my top. Let me tell you about, and he just sort of this half hour monologue on how his Tottenham had done this kind of fractionally earlier than the Everton team I was talking about.
All right. Jonathan Wilson, author of Inverting the Pyramid, and I think 11 other books. Is that correct?
That is right now, yeah, because my novel is just coming out on Eduard Streltsov, my first novel. So please do buy that this Christmas as well.
Oh, what is the name of the novel?
It's called Streltsov. It's just the surname of this Soviet player from 1958, who was a great player. And then on the eve of the 58 World Cup, he was arrested maybe because he committed the crime, and maybe because politics intervened.
Well, consider it purchased and soon to be read by myself. Thank you so much.
Excellent.
Jonathan Wilson, I appreciate your time, and thanks for fighting through this. We're all big fans here in Dallas.
Best of luck to whoever has to edit that.
Merry Christmas to you and yours, sir.
You too. Thank you very much.
All right. So that took...
Are you really going to read that book?
Yeah, I will.
You're being honest.
Yeah, I will read it. Yeah. Right. And I'm not a big reader, but I really like the way he writes. That's Jonathan Wilson. He writes for The Guardian and also wrote Inverting the Pyramid. If you're a Ted Lasso fan, that's the book that Coach Beard is seen reading. It's an actual book about soccer tactics. If you're interested in the game, it's an absolute must read, and I really appreciate Jonathan. We had a ton of technical problems. That interview, I'm going to post the full interview. There's about almost a 30-minute version of that where it gets super nerdy that I thought I'd cut out
for
this today.
Well done for pulling it off. Well done for pulling it off. But I listening to it just made me think about what's next in terms of tactical development.
Yeah.
Some team needs to go back to the WM. They need to roll out with a 2-3-5. How would you defend it?
That's true.
Sometimes things go full circle, and that's what might be next.
Yeah. All right. We're running super late, so let's take a break. When we come back, Tyler Kern joins us for our last segment to talk a little Bundesliga next on The Kick Around. All right. Thanks again to Jonathan Wilson for doing that. I will post the entire interview on our podcast that you'll be able to find at on the website, thekickaround.com. This will be our last segment of the day and last live segment of the year. And Arsenal Leeds just finished up shortly. Arsenal pummeled Leeds 4-1. Arsenal continues to look good and in good shape. Leeds, on the other hand, now have given up, Andy, sit back, 16 goals in their last four games.
Their goal difference is atrocious, and they're only hoping they don't end up tied for points for that relegation spot.
All right.
Lose.
And there are three big games tomorrow. The top three teams all do, at least at this point in time, play tomorrow. To be determined if that actually happens. We will now dial up via the miracle of the internet our good friend Tyler Kern to talk all things Bundesliga. Come in, Tyler.
Hello, gentlemen. Wow. Making me follow Jonathan Wilson is rough. That's rough.
How many times have you read Inverting the Pyramid?
Once, but it's fantastic.
It is great, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It really is an encyclopedia for soccer tactics. It's fantastic if you haven't listened, or if you haven't read it. It's a great read.
Tyler, what would happen if a team just rolled out with a 2-3-5 randomly one day?
The WM, as they referred to it.
I feel like we see Dortmund try that on a week-in, week-out basis, and it doesn't really go so great most of the time. So
maybe your idea and all that hotty-totty Swifty.
Right. Okay. Back to the drawing board.
All right, Tyler Kern is here to talk all things Bundesliga. That is his league of jam. And my number one thing going into this conversation with you, Tyler, is all of the talk of Erling Haaland's likely sale from Dortmund because of the chances... Like is Dortmund at risk of not making Champions League? Is that what's going on, or is it just because there's so much money at stake that it's likely he's out of there?
I mean, his deal has a release clause that gets triggered this summer for $75 million, which is less than what his market value would reasonably be if he were just to hit the open market. And so I think that's probably the primary thing, is that maybe Dortmund is sitting there saying that, hey, maybe in January we get more money because a team that thinks, oh, if it's just anybody that wants to pay $75 million in the summer and then he gets his choice of teams, they might come in with a bigger offer in January and say, okay, let's just nip this in the bud now and make sure that we get him in a deal with Dortmund. That I could see that perhaps happening. I don't think so. I think Dortmund's going to hold on to him until the summer, and then he'll leave for $75 million to Real Madrid, Manchester City, one of those types of teams. But I think Dortmund has to look at this period in their team's history as just a massive missed opportunity to have Jadon Sancho and Erling Haaland on the same team for a number of years, and to not win a title and to not really even come close to winning a title, and then to see both of them leave in back-to-back summers, I think is going to be one of those things that you look back on and say, how did that team not win anything with those two guys? I think that's going to be a massive missed opportunity.
All right, Tyler, I let you off the hook for the first question, but it's now time where Andy and I express our displeasure with you.
And this has nothing to do with Union Berlin either.
No. Andy and I came to you as the de facto Bundesliga guy, and we asked you to tell us all about the promise and hope of an American coach in the Bundesliga under Jesse Marsch at Red Bull Leipzig, and I ended up being my team that the wheel anointed to me, and you told us that everything's going to be all right. In fact, I think you almost pinky sweared that he was going to work out. And since we last talked to you, Jesse Marsch, right?
Yeah, and even the last time we spoke, we asked, hey, is he okay? Are we okay here? And you're like,
yeah,
he's okay.
What went wrong with the American Jesse Marsch at Red Bull Leipzig?
Red Bull Leipzig, I thought they would have a little bit more patience with Jesse Marsch because I thought that they would understand what the situation was. Turns out I was very wrong. Also, the last time we spoke, you know, it was following a 5-0 win that they had in the Champions League against Club Brugge. And then
looking
they had
pretty
a game,
rosy.
It was looking good. And then they had a game the following day after we spoke against Leverkusen, and I thought, okay, if they win that game, they're all of a sudden up into a Champions League spot, then they're okay. They ended up losing that game. Then they ended up losing midweek to Union Berlin, and then he lost his job. So it was three straight defeats in the Bundesliga, and that's kind of what cost him. But it's kind of similar to almost an FC Dallas situation, where every offseason they sell their best players, and yet they expect a linear type of success. Like this offseason, they sold both of their center backs and maybe their most important midfielder in Marcel Sabitzer. Two of those players going to Bayern, and Bayern gets better and Leipzig doesn't. And then they bring in a new coach and anticipate that everything's just going to keep rolling on smoothly. And then when it doesn't, they kind of pull the trigger really quickly on firing a manager. I don't know. To me, I don't think it was a situation that that you can reasonably expect Champions League level success from your manager immediately in the first half of the season. I understand what their concerns were, that they weren't progressing, that they weren't looking better. Rafael Honigstein, who writes for The Athletic and covers the Bundesliga, says Jesse Marsch was maybe the right coach at the wrong time for RB Leipzig, and I kind of think that might be the case, just that following Julian Nagelsmann, that the way that they played had changed to an extent to where the former way of Red Bull soccer just wasn't going to work this time around, and maybe that's what ended up biting him.
There were some rumors, and you know, who knows if this is true, emanating, you know, out of that situation, that Marsch wasn't, I don't want to say not respected by the players, but you know, I just wonder if we had another case of Bob Bradley going to EPL at Swansea, if we had Jesse Marsch, the American coach, now going to coach in the Bundesliga, and the play, you know, just not enough skins on the wall, I guess, or because of his background, that the players maybe didn't respect them. And a lot of it might be subconscious.
Well,
you know?
But I wonder how much of this is an American coach taking an opportunity because it's the one opportunity they're given at a top level gig, but it's also a really crummy opportunity. Like, it's like they're not set up to win.
Yeah, they're set up to fail because he went into a club that had success and could only go down, basically.
Well,
right?
Bradley at Swansea is a great, I mean, it was never going to work out.
Let's see what Tyler has to say about this. Tyler.
No, I agree with that, you know, and I think that we as Americans tend to focus in just very specifically on the cases where we have players and coaches that get up to those top levels and then hone in on those things. And Derek Ray talked a little bit about this. He's a big Bundesliga guy as well. And if you don't follow him on Twitter, he's worth following just for all of his Bundesliga knowledge. But he said, I wish Scottish fans cared as much about the success of their managers and their players as Americans do. But in this case, he thought there wasn't any sort of bias. And I kind of disagree. I think there's that underlying skepticism of non-German coaches or coaches from non-traditional soccer markets coming in and then trying to show them how the game should be done and trying to change things. I think there is just that underlying skepticism of you have to prove it to us that you can. And as soon as trouble starts to show, then you're not given that opportunity to try to fix things. And so I think you start off a little bit behind the eight ball as an American in this type of scenario. And I think Bob Bradley was really a similar case trying to go into the Premier League and do it at Swansea, a team that clearly just wasn't good enough to be in the Premier League to begin with.
All right, Chris Richards is applying his trade on loan at Hoffenheim and actually was player of the game. Isn't that correct? Didn't he win a player of the game award a week or so ago and scored a winning goal?
Yeah, he scored his first goal in the Bundesliga, a header off of a corner kick. So good for Chris Richards, yep. Former FC Dallas kid. Did not get off the bench today for Hoffenheim in a game that they drew 1-1 against Mönchengladbach.
Maybe that coach has learned a lesson now.
Something like that. I don't know. Other Americans in the Bundesliga, Joe Scally played 90 minutes today for Gladbach in that 1-1 draw. Joe Scally, I mean, left back, playing in the Bundesliga at 18 years old. Not someone that we've talked about a lot or that you hear a ton of buzz about, but someone just to keep an eye on because he never looks out of place. He's not Marcelo by any means as a left back. You know, he's not bombing up and down the left side and creating attacking opportunities, but just quietly solid as an 18-year-old in the Bundesliga.
There's only one Marcelo, Tyler. You do know that, right?
I do. Don't I? Don't I?
What is going? John Brooks essentially probably needs to retire at this point because isn't he done for at this? I just hear and read nothing but terrible reports about John Brooks' form of late.
His form has been bad, and he played, he started for Wolfsburg. Look, Wolfsburg in general have just been really bad. They were the first coach to fire their manager this season, Mark Van Bommel, and then brought in Florian Kohfeldt, the former coach of Werder Bremen, who got them relegated. Again, another German manager getting another chance after relegating a team, whereas Americans just get fired. But anyways, that's neither here nor there. But Wolfsburg have lost 7 straight in all competitions and lost 4-0 to Bayern on Friday. And John Brooks started that game at center back. And yeah, he's looked inconsistent. He's looked bad, but the team in general has just looked really, really bad. So the team is bad with John Brooks. They're bad without John Brooks. He's been a maddeningly inconsistent player throughout his entire career. We've seen him throw up stinkers in CONCACAF World Cup qualifying games as well. And so you know that he has that in him, but he also has the ability to be the best center back in the U.S. men's national team pool. So I think he'll probably move on from Wolfsburg sooner rather than later. I'll be curious to see where he ends up if it's not another Bundesliga team. I kind of think it will be.
All right, and Bayern Munich's magic number right now currently is what, like 3 or something?
Right. Well, Borussia Dortmund just lost 3-2 today to Hertha Berlin, which is just, I mean, it was just a terrible performance from Borussia Dortmund. They went up 1-0 and then gave up the next 3 goals. Their back line just looks like Swiss cheese most of the time. They had Axel Witsel, who's normally a defensive midfielder playing center back. Emre Can looking mediocre as well as a defensive midfielder. They don't look like they have an idea when it comes to defending and lost the game 3-2, which just widens Bayern's lead at the top of the table. It was so close just a few weeks ago when we were talking.
Another promise of yours that we would have a close Bundesliga race this year.
I don't think I promised that. We'll go back to the tape on
that. You said it would be different this year. You said it would be tight. No? You gave us hope? No?
Maybe did not. I? If I did,
I maybe I just wanted to hear that.
Yeah, I think you might just be hearing what you want to hear. Yeah. But you heard Jonathan Wilson talk about that a little bit, just that there's a self-perpetuating cycle of the teams that do well, get more money, get more exposure, continue to do well. And you almost need them to make a mistake, the way Juventus kind of maybe made a mistake, appointing the wrong manager, paying way too much money for Cristiano Ronaldo. Bayern's just so smart. They haven't really made a mistake yet. And you almost need that for the other teams to catch up. And you also need those teams to take advantage of their opportunities. And Dortmund just hasn't done that, hasn't shown the ability to be put together enough or have conjoined thinking to be able to do that. So that looks like another Bayern Munich.
Yeah, of course win. It is. All right. That there is the amazing Tyler Kern, our friend. We love you so much, Tyler. Happy Merry Christmas to you.
Love you, boys. Merry Christmas to y'all as well.
All right. We will speak to Tyler next time where he will provide us more Bundesliga insight. Go forth, Tyler, and have a great holiday season.
Thanks, guys. You too.
See you, Tyler.
Andy, we have now completed yet another amazing, fun episode of The Kick Around.
It was another episode.
Are you disappointed in the quality of this episode?
Just, you know.
We never get to do live shows anymore.
Yeah, better enjoy it. It lasts for about 3 weeks. So.
Yeah. What's wrong?
Nothing. No, good. It's all good. I was just
not enough Andy on the show today or something?
No, plenty of Andy.
Well, next week, Peter and I will, next time, Peter and I will just leave.
That's
do it
maybe the
yourself.
Problem.
Not enough Liverpool talk or
maybe
something?
Maybe not enough Liverpool talk.
Did you want to talk about the Trent goal?
God, amazing goal, huh?
I was actually having a debate with a Liverpool friend over the differences between Thiago's strike a couple of weeks ago and Trent's goal the other day and which one was better.
Thiago's.
Yeah. Thiago's, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. All right, don't forget, you'll be able to listen to the entire Wilson interview on our website, thekickaround.com. Thanks to the Jacobs. Thanks to the Sam's P1s. We love and adore you. Get out, get stuck in, and win your 50s.